Science is a progressive thing. We continue to learn more and more each year about the world around us, and as we do, some ideas are kicked to the curb as they are discovered to be untrue, or at the least, they are modified to more accurately reflect what we believe to be the truth of the situation. What was true yesterday might not be true today, even if we staunchly believe it to have been true before we found out it was wrong. And so it goes with each new thing that's put forth as the new gospel truth. The earth was flat, the sun revolved around the earth, leeches were an effective medical treatment, and Pluto was a planet, wasn't a planet, is a planet. The thing is that the facts as we know them will likely continue to change as we learn more. Some will be found to be true while others will be let go, recognized as faulty thinking. Some may continue to persist as myth because, doggone it, it can be really hard to let go of an idea once we have it in our minds, can't it? Some of those myths, some of those faulty thoughts, are outdoor related and I still run into them on occasion. Let's see if we can clear up a few today. Welcome to Bristol Bay Field Notes. I'm Terry Fuller, Education Specialist for Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. For those of you who don't yet own a small handheld GPS or even a compass, if you get lost, don't necessarily depend on moss on trees to get you home. There is a very old school of thought that moss grows on the north side of trees and therefore can be used for finding direction. Well, maybe, but maybe not. What moss does like has less to do with direction and more to do with two factors, shade and moisture. Because of our planet's tilt, it's true that the north sides of trees tend to be shadier than the south sides, at least in the northern hemisphere. For those of us in Alaska, that makes it a likely scenario. However, there are a number of factors that can go into suitable growing conditions for mosses, including density of foliage, humidity, and tree location. Also, some mosses have been found to have strong preferences for specific tree species. All that to say that moss on a given tree around the refuge might give you which way is north, but it's far from ironclad. The bottom line? Save up your pennies and get yourself a GPS, or at the very least a solid compass, and learn how to use it. Fall seems to bring about an infusion of spiders, or possibly it's just a keener sense of awareness for their presence for many folks, and the reason is simple. As temperatures begin to drop, spiders, and other small things like insects, seek out warmer areas, namely the insides of our homes. It's not unusual for more spiders to be seen indoors as the calendar chugs toward its end. That's true in a lot of places. When I lived in Kansas, we'd see wolf spiders, fairly large ones, begin to show up in the house during the fall months. It's no different here, though spider size is quite a bit smaller. One of the spider types that gets seen the most, we seem to have gobs and gobs of them, are what most folks term daddy long legs or dipdoolies. I spoke of them on here a year ago, and I'd like to say just one thing about them that continues to be a bit of a myth. They're not venomous at all, no matter what you may have heard. Harvestmen, their true name, are arachnids, but not true spiders. They have a fused main body, whereas true spiders have separate body parts. Though I realize that for those of you that have a fear of spiders, you're probably not going to get close enough to make that distinction. Just remember, they are very much a Franklin Delano Roosevelt kind of spider. The only thing you have to fear is fear itself, not the threat of being bitten by one. Something else I've mentioned on here before, but perhaps bears another quick mention due to its long-standing history in the myth department, is the fact that porcupines can't and don't shoot their quills. It just doesn't happen. The quills are modified hairs, and a porcupine has a whole lot of them, something like 30,000 when it comes to those of the North American species. And the quills have very sharp tips and dozens of tiny barbs near the tip that help them to become embedded in whatever they happen to come in contact with. They are loosely attached to the porcupine's skin, so they detach fairly easily. Even a very slight touch can dislodge dozens at a time. Here's a funny to consider when you think about quills. Porcupines sometimes stick themselves. How, you ask? Their main dietary source is tree bark. They spend a lot of time in trees, and they're actually pretty good climbers, especially considering their size. But they are not immune to falling, and when they do fall, they sometimes stick themselves. Also, they'll stick each other during what can be extremely violent mating battles between males over a receptive female. Even then, they have an adaptation that serves as something of an insurance policy. The quills have a coating that serves as something of a crude antibiotic that helps stave off infection for those times when they get a bit clumsy while climbing or when battling to secure the attentions of a female porcupine. But if you think a porcupine is going to shoot its quills, well, it's pretty likely that you're way, way too close. And if you're not close, you're safe, honest. So a bigger threat than a lethal bite from a daddy longlegs or the risk of having a porcupine go all Legolas on you would be the threat posed by a bear. And even then, with bears and their teeth and claws being real, I'd suggest rather strongly that the threat is extremely overblown, if not entirely mythic. I do field enough questions from people new to the area to realize that a fair number do believe the potential is there for a bear behind every tree, and most of them seem to be in bad moods. Fact, we do have a fair number of brown bears in our part of the state. Fact, they can pose a danger if you're acting in a careless way or not paying attention to your surroundings. Fact, your chances of having a bad encounter are very, very low, even with our area's bear numbers. Let me pass some numbers by you to back up that claim. These numbers are from data compiled by the Wildlife Research Institute. Do you spend any time around dogs? Or own a dog, perhaps? You are 45 times more likely to be killed by a dog than a bear. Or, how about this? The odds of dying at the hands, or rather stingers, of a bee or bunch of bees is 120 times greater than dying from a bear attack. And you're 250 times more likely to be killed by lightning than bears. Yet you don't see or hear of anyone moving to Alaska and hopping off a plane and exclaiming, "Dogs and bees and lightning, oh my." No, bears are the big concern. That's because they are the sensational concern. Do folks die from bear attacks? Sure. According to an article in Backpacker magazine, a little less than 3 people per year for all bear types across all of North America. National Geographic puts the odds at 1 in 2.1 million, which means the odds of it happening are extremely low. Want to know how to make those odds go down even more? Just be smart when you're doing stuff outside. Stay away from areas that have high concentrations of bears. Always be alert and travel with other people, and when possible, travel with the wind at your back. Surprise bears, sows with cubs, and stumbling across a food source are the big concerns when it comes to bears. So take steps to avoid being in those situations, and the odds go down to almost nothing. Angry bears behind every tree? Not even close. It's a nice story, an embellishment of sorts, for when you're visiting with friends and family in the lower 48. But it's nowhere close to reality. And while we're starting to pull away from certain summer activities at a pretty good pace, let's tackle this outdoor-related myth, that you have to wait after eating before you can go swimming. Seriously, have any of you ever been told that? Or told it to your kids? There is a very nice lake near my hometown where my parents and their friends used to spend weekends in the summer when I was growing up. Crystal clear waters, nice sand beaches. It was nice, especially if you liked to swim, which we did. One of the absolutes of my summertime childhood was the admonition that I couldn't go swimming after eating. The recommended time seemed to be something along the lines of 30 to 60 minutes. Well, I'm here to tell you today that particular nugget of parental wisdom falls squarely in the myth column. It was certainly almost universally accepted when I was a child, and I think a fair number of folks still subscribe to it today. It's thought that the thinking behind this came about due to the possibility of suffering severe muscle cramps and drowning from swimming on a full stomach. While there is some kernel of truth there, digestion can divert blood flow towards the gut and away from muscles, there has never been a documented case of drowning because of swimming on a full stomach. Also, there is this. The American Red Cross does not make any specific recommendations about waiting any length of time after eating before swimming. You'd like to think if this were a possibility, they'd have it covered. Such is not the case. Theoretically, you could cramp up and drown. It has never, ever happened or been documented, though. Think of it this way. You've got a better chance of getting mauled by a bear than you do of cramping up because you went swimming right after eating. And there's like no chance at all that you're going to get mauled by a bear, because the bees and the dogs will get to you first. And we're not even factoring in the risk you may incur every time you climb into an automobile. In spite of all that, I would urge the following. Ignore the bees, dogs, and bears and get outside. Fall is such a magnificent time to be outside, even if in Alaska, you can almost measure it with a kitchen timer. Be safe while you're out there, but get outdoors and enjoy the time we have. For Field Notes, I'm Terry Fuller. Music from Loon Echo Lake provided courtesy of Solitudes at www.solitudes.com.